Welcome to the Cello Sherpa Podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Matt Heimovitz made his debut at the age of 13 as soloist with Zubin Mehta and the Israel Philharmonic. At 17 years old, he made his first recording with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for Deutsche Grammophon. He has gone on to perform on the world's most esteemed stages with such orchestras as the Berlin Philharmonic, the New York Philharmonic, the Boston Symphony, and worked with many of the most esteemed conductors in our field. He is currently Associate Professor of Cello at McGill University's Schulich School of Music in Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa Podcast.
Wonderful to be with you.
So I grew up in North Jersey, and you are about a year older than I am, and my mother was a music columnist for the New York Times. So she took me to all kinds of concerts, sometimes begrudgingly, admittedly, but I distinctly remember that you were all the rage when I was about 14 years old, and I was extremely envious of watching you perform on the biggest stage with the biggest stars at that age. It was amazing. Do you remember exactly how you suddenly burst onto the scene like that at such a young age?
Well, it was a kind of a series of events, but it began really with meeting Itzhak Perlman at the Academy of the West in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. I was studying with a Hungarian cellist who was a student of Pablo Casals. His name was Gábor Rajtó. And I was playing in a masterclass for Gábor Rajtó, and Perlman was in the audience and heard me play and invited me over the next day for some pasta and to meet his kids and just hang out in Santa Barbara. And from there, he really took a strong interest and mentored me and introduced me to Leonard Rose, the great cellist and teacher. And Mr. Rose invited me to come and study with him on the condition that my family would move to New York from Palo Alto. One thing led to the next. And then between Mr. Rose and Itzhak Perlman, they introduced me to Zubin Mehta, and I played for Zubin, and Zubin invited me to make my debut with the Israel Philharmonic and then the New York Philharmonic. And then, you know, one thing led to another. Another encounter at the Perlman household with Daniel Barenboim, where we just read chamber music, Brahms Sonata, and some other things. And Daniel, at that point, had not played with another cellist since Jacqueline Dupré. And so it was a very emotional and moving moment. And then he invited me to make my European debut in London. And it was really just from there, just one thing after the next. It was a little bit, you know, at that age, I didn't even think twice about it. It seemed normal to me, but of course it's not normal. It was really very exceptional, kind of very fortunate series of circumstances. And I mean, now looking back, it looks like another life, you know, looking back at that time. I mean, now everything has changed in the world and the recording industry and the classical music world. I mean, it's a very different world out there. But I'm a very different artist, and never would have imagined that I would follow the path that I did. But yeah, it did start off with quite a bang in the 1980s.
So your parents moved all the way from California to New York specifically for you to have this opportunity?
Yes. They moved from Israel to Palo Alto. They immigrated in the mid-1970s. Mm-hmm. And then they, particularly my mother, wanted to support what I was going through with the cello and music. And they made a big sacrifice to do that and moved to my sister and myself.
Wow. That's amazing. Did they have to find new jobs, or what was the profession that they were in?
Well, my mother was a pianist. And yes, they both kind of found new jobs. She was the artistic director of the Hebrew Arts School in New York for many years. In Palo Alto, she taught piano. She had, you know, 40 students a week, mm-hmm. where she taught a private studio. My father was an engineer and was recruited. That was the original idea to move to Palo Alto. So he worked for one of the Silicon Valley companies. And he kind of had a midlife situation where he wanted to do something else and got into real estate. And then he was happy to continue the real estate in New York City.
So here you were, and at the time you were 12, 13 when this first happened?
Exactly.
And did you have any idea what was about to happen to you, or did you just see each thing happen and you just sort of rolled with it because you're 13?
Oh, I had no idea. The only thing I knew was that, you know, I wanted to do as much with the cello as I could. And I was pretty voracious in terms of wanting to understand how the mechanics of it. And I was just thrilled to start studying with Leonard Rose, who in my mind, even to this day, had the most beautiful cello sound that I've ever heard. So I, you know, to have that as an example. And Mr. Rose also, not only was he a great cellist and performer, but he also was a very devoted teacher and really could articulate every aspect of what he did on the instrument. So it was really amazing to work with him and to have that kind of instruction and example. The examples that he would give, you know, the playing was just so exquisite.
Yeah. And then, so you were studying with him, and did you end up attending Juilliard to study with him, or did you then start touring all over the world? Talk about how that unfolded, and you signed a record deal with Deutsche Grammophon, I know, at 17. And what happened through those years that sort of unfolded to put you on the trajectory of where you ended up?
Well, yeah, I mean, he certainly introduced me to certain conductors, and but by the time I started recording, he had passed away. So I started recording for Deutsche Grammophon at 17. And yeah, that first record was with Chicago Symphony and James Levine conducting. So that was my first real experience recording. And from there, it was really my first year in college that I started to open up to genres of music outside of classical and began to work with living composers. I started, you know, sort of a year after I started recording for Deutsche Grammophon, I decided I would record a solo album of 20th century works, including Benjamin Britten and Reger, and then also George Crumb. And the week that I was recording outside of Salzburg, the Ligeti Sonata was just published, even though it had been written in sort of the late 1940s, early 50s. And my producer just came by with it, with the score, and said, "Look, you're recording a solo album. Look what just was published." And so I read it down, and unbeknownst to me, in the studio, Deutsche Grammophon was recording my reading of it. And they sent it to Georgi Ligeti, who was living in Hamburg at that time. And I received a call a few days later as we were taking a break from our solo recording, and he called, and I immediately jumped on the opportunity. I had never really worked with a living composer before. And I started asking him all these questions, you know, like, how is my tempo? How am I doing with this phrase or that articulation? And he said, you know, I don't discuss music over the phone. I'd like you to make the first recording of this piece, but you have to come to Hamburg and work. We'll work together. And then you can go back and record it. And I said, okay, I'm getting on the next flight. So we got, you know, these flights from Salzburg to Hamburg. I worked with him for several hours. I think it was like 4 or 5 hours on this 7 or 8 minute piece. And he knew exactly what he wanted. And it was a very humbling experience to have, you know, to have a composer who really could tell me what he liked, what he didn't like, what to change, a couple of things that he wanted to change in his score after hearing me play it. But it was definitely, it made me question everything that I was doing in terms of when I played Bach or when I played Beethoven, you know, and I can't have these conversations with these composers because they're not alive, but I should be having these conversations. So it made me want to work with as many composers as I could. And so from that moment, I started seeking out living composers. And I started, because I was recording for Deutsche Grammophon, it started with some of the European composers, John Oberio, Hans Werner Henze, Henri Dutilleux, wonderful composer who was in Paris. So yeah, all of these composers, and then gradually I started to get to know more American composers, and that's where I was living and sort of grew my circle.
That sounds like it was a real turning point for you. When you were looking at your career moving forward as a teenager, how did you envision it versus how it ended up unfolding? Can you get a little bit into that?
Mr. Rose really didn't like 20th century music for the most part. In fact, one of his greatest performances that I heard on a bootleg recording was a Barber Concerto that he did with Leonard Bernstein at Carnegie Hall. And apparently Bernstein had to twist his arm to play it. Mr. Rose didn't want to play it.
Yeah.
So that's not something that we really worked on with Mr. Rose. I mean, occasionally, you know, Shostakovich or something like that, he might accept, but he wasn't into it. So we played mostly 19th century music with Mr. Rose. And that's what he loved. That's what he was really passionate about. And that's what I thought I would be doing. That's I thought I would be playing concertos, you know, the Dvorak, the Schumann, the Elgar, and so on. And I thought that that's what my life would look like. I had no idea about arranging music from other genres, about working on new music, about performance practice and learning about Baroque bows and gut strings and different tunings and all that. I had no idea. And I'd had no idea that, although Mr. Rose was definitely a model for me, so I had a feeling that I would teach at some point, but I didn't know at that early stage that I would have a studio at a university. And, you know, I teach not only at McGill University, but also at New School in New York City at Manus.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I do kind of an artist in residence there. So I do both. And, you know, that's become very, very important to me.
Yeah. So was there a number of years that you were doing sort of the standard concerto circuit with all the orchestras before you made that shift to focusing more on contemporary works with working with living composers?
Yeah, I think from like 1984 to 1989, 1990, something. So there was a period of 5-6 years where I just played the standard concerto, standard repertoire.
Yeah.
For those years. And then the minute I discovered new music, that really opened things up for me and it was like a window into not only a whole new world, but also a new perspective on the old world, you know, in terms of just opened up my ears and the tools that I was using of interpretation and the questions that I could have, the dialogue that I could have with composers who weren't around anymore.
Yeah. Well, I know you've recently released a new album. Is Primavera 1 and 2, is that correct?
Yeah, and Primavera 3 is coming out soon.
Oh, great. Why don't you tell us about those details then?
Well, Primavera refers to a painting. It's the Sandro Botticelli painting, which the Primavera, this iconic painting that hangs at the Uffizi in Florence, Italy. My partner, Jeffrey Ann Young, and I were mesmerized by this painting. We saw it at the Uffizi and just really fascinated with all the questions in it and the narratives and the Greek mythology and Roman mythology. I mean, just there's so much there to contemplate. And we also started working and met a living painter, Charlene von Hael, German painter who resides between Marfa, Texas and New York City. Mm-hmm. And she created for us a reaction response to the Botticelli painting. So now we have these two paintings, Primavera 2020. She finished her painting right before the pandemic hit, and the old painting. So 500 years separate these two paintings. And essentially, we all had the idea to commission composers to engage these two paintings and create a bridge between them. Yeah, that's what we've been doing. And the idea is to commission 81 composers. Kind of nuts. You know, we started with 9 composers and those 9 recommend the next 9 and those 9 recommend the next 9. So it kind of gets me out of my comfort zone. So I'm not working only with the composers that I'm used to working with all the time. It goes beyond that. And new languages, new musical languages, new techniques on the instrument, you know, very diverse set of group of people and kind of incredible project and very organic. And we just sort of started doing this. We're about halfway there. So as you said, we have Primavera 1 and 2. Primavera 3 is coming very soon. We've been recording all of this repertoire. We're about halfway there with the 81. So we have about 35 to 40 of them now recorded of these pieces. Uh-huh. We've been recording in Charlene von Hael's studio. Actually, her and her husband, Christopher Wohl, they have two artist studios with beautiful cathedral ceilings. It's old hardware stores converted into these artist spaces in Marfa, Texas.
Oh, cool.
And the sound is just wonderful. And my cello loves it. So it's like a extension of the cello, you know, in that space. And we've been recording with the producer, David Frost, in New York City, receiving high def sound from Marfa, Texas to New York and producing it. And we have an engineer, Richard King, and then Brian Losh, who are there in Marfa, setting up the mics and doing sound. And it's just been magical, you know, through the whole pandemic. Even when Montreal was locked down and New York was locked down, we could go to Marfa and just breathe the air and record to our heart's content at any hour of the day and night and do this. So I'm looking forward to the next year and completing the commissions. And then it's been kind of a wild ride. The painting was in Marfa the entire time. Charlene's painting, that is, not the Botticelli, but the Charlene's painting was with me in the room as I was recording for the last 2 years or year and a half. And now it has left Marfa, Texas. So the Primavera 2020 is now hanging in Venice, Italy. It's featured as one of the paintings in the Venice Biennale. So if you can get to Venice, you can go check out Primavera 2020. And there's a whole room there at the Biennale that features her artwork. And several of the paintings, well, all the paintings that are there after Primavera 2020, she created after hearing the music. So it's kind of going back and forth. You know, the composers are reacting to her paintings. She's reacting to the music that she's hearing in her studio. And it's just become a very close relationship. And I could not tell you where this whole project will end, but I'm hoping there's some theatrical way to somehow bring these two paintings together so people can experience what we're experiencing in our minds in terms of going between the ages, the cycles of history, the unbelievable journey that we still, even 500 years ago to now, to probably the next 500 years, if we manage to take care of our planet, that we're all sort of connected in this way through time, through all the various pandemics and wars and everything that human beings go through. We share this commonality and human nature, and it's kind of amazing to bring it back to these two paintings.
Yeah, that's so cool. And it's all solo cello, right?
It's all solo cello. The initial idea was to do it like cello tone poems, you know, for cello and orchestra. But then the pandemic hit and we thought, okay, let's just shift this to solo cello because that's all I can really do. I did record some multi-cello tracks where I recorded all the parts. Again, because of the pandemic, I would have been happier to play with other people. Yeah, so there were two pieces, one by composer Lisa Bialawa and another Missy Mazzoli. Mm-hmm. Both those composers independently gravitated to Josquin des Prez's music. Josquin was around the same time as Botticelli. And I don't know if they met, but he was in Florence. And so Lisa's piece is based on a Josquin piece. It's a four-part vocal piece, and with Missy Mazzoli, it's a six-part piece, the Praetor Rerum Serium, and I arranged those for four cellos and six cellos, respectively. And so there are a couple of multi-cello tracks. There's one composer, Teksu Kim, who wrote a four-cello piece, and I overdubbed those four parts.
Well, this way you don't have to complain at all the other people for doing things you don't like.
No, I can complain about myself, and it's a lot cheaper, actually, if I do it myself, but yeah.
And so just to share with our audience, so Primavera 1, does that refer to like the first album, and Primavera 2 is the second album, and they're all just the length of a CD, or is this all just being done digitally?
Yeah, I mean, it could be any length, really, but yeah, it's all digitally right now, and we're talking about creating an LP, actually, and maybe a CD at some point.
Okay.
So, but right now, it's just digital, and so yeah, it's got the Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But it also has a subtitle. So the first one is The Wind, and the second one is The Rabbits. Mm-hmm. So Primavera 2, The Rabbits. And we're just naming them after details of Charlene Van Hale's painting. The rabbits are kind of a circular form where the three graces are in the Botticelli paintings. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of symbolism to the rabbits. And Charlene uses rabbits in a lot of her paintings. So it's a theme, that a leitmotif that runs through her work.
Cool. Delightful. Well, you've been on faculty since 2004 at McGill. Can you talk about the environment there, what kinds of students you have, how big your studio is? Just give us an idea of what you have going on there.
Yeah, generally, I've had a studio that's usually between 12 and 15 students. You know, it varies each year, but and we've done a lot of projects with the cello ensemble at McGill, UCello. So one of those projects, Meeting the Spirits, was treating the cello ensemble like a big band, and that was a Grammy-nominated album. So my students just did incredible work with that. It's kind of amazing, actually, when you look at eight cellos, but it sounds like a big band. And so you've got a rhythm section, you've got sort of electric guitar, you've got, you know, the horn section, and it doesn't quite add up. You see one thing and you're hearing another. It's very, very interesting. That was a really very fun project to work on.
Sounds like it.
But we've done other things. We did a children's story, Angel Heart, with Cornelia Funke, the great children's author, wrote a story for us, and Luna Perlwolf wrote the music for five cellos and narrator. And we did that with Jeremy Irons and some incredible actors actually along the way in various places, including Carnegie Hall. We performed that. So we've done some really interesting things with UCello, and a couple of my arrangements of Jimi Hendrix, Machine Gun, one of the great war protest songs, and arranged that for eight cellos. We did some Led Zeppelin together and some other things. We've had some fun. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to, in the pandemic, do anything with the ensemble, but so that happens at McGill. And at New School, I also incorporate teaching a class, and that's been really fascinating, you know, kind of dreaming up really crazy ideas, looking at, you know, let's say Bach or Beethoven performance practice, but also commissioning new works that respond to the old. So, you know, sort of overtures to the Bach suites, which I myself did, but then at the school, we do that with students and workshop the new pieces, and then talk about performance of the older works and sort of just reframing what we're doing and putting it in a new perspective.
Yeah. Would you say that all of the students that you have are planning on going into a career in music?
You know, at McGill and New School, yes, most of them are, but not all of them. I have some students who are now attorneys and, you know, who do other things. You just never know. But it's wonderful to see how meaningful musical studies were and how they put it to use in various ways. But some of them just continue playing and have a string quartet that they play, and they're, you know, they are more amateurs at this point. But most of them, I would say, go into careers and either in orchestra, or I've had students found chamber orchestras. Uh-huh. One former doctoral student of mine, she founded Collective Neuf with her boyfriend. It's a very popular string orchestra in Canada, and they're doing incredible things, commissioning new work and arranging for the ensemble. And
yeah,
a whole range, and some of them are now teaching at university level. And yeah, I've been teaching long enough that it's kind of nice to see how they're doing. I had a couple of principal cellists in Canada in some of the orchestras. And
that's great.
Yeah, it's exciting.
And what do you look for then in a potential new student at all the schools that you're teaching at?
That's a very good question. I it's really important to me to have chemistry and to feel like there's a give and take. Mm-hmm. I need to have feedback from a student, so it's not just a one direction kind of experience. And at the same time, as a teacher, you want to hear and see that you're making an impact and that your ideas are being absorbed in some way or that are having an effect.
Yeah.
To me, that's very, very important, as important as the level of talent, actually, that a student has. And, you know, you're going to spend up to 4 years as an undergrad with the students. So that's a significant amount of time one-on-one with the person. So you have to get along and you have to trust each other, and that's very important. It's sometimes very hard to know if it's going to work or not.
Yeah. I was going to say, can you see that in an actual audition, or do you need to do some trial lessons with students before you would consider taking them?
Trial lessons are very helpful, very, very helpful. And I think I've been teaching long enough now, 25 years, that at the college level that, you know, I can tell a lot in an audition, but you can't always tell. And sometimes, you know, someone is unbelievable in the audition And then you meet them later and you realize, oh my goodness, there's no common language to kind of work from. And it's very, very challenging. So I think I've gotten pretty good at being able to tell with all the life experience that I've developed over 25 years, but you never know. You never know. And the having that mock lesson, trial lesson is really very helpful for the student too, because the student has to make a choice.
Right.
And it's a big commitment to sort of put yourself in this professor's hands for that period of time. So that's, I think it's very helpful. We try to do that as much as possible.
Well, now with the pandemic, the one silver lining is you can do it virtually, I assume. That wasn't really acceptable a few years ago.
Unbelievable. What I was so skeptical about online lessons. I remember having a conversation with Lynn Harrell about it, and he was doing lots of online lessons. And I was like, really? You know, that works? It didn't appeal to me at all.
Yeah.
And then with the pandemic, we were forced to go to Zoom and do it. And I have to say, I mean, it was a little much to do an entire year in both schools just online.
Yeah.
We didn't do any in person for a year. And that was a little much. But I was really impressed with how much we could accomplish with students. So now we incorporate, you know, I would say 10, 20% of the lessons are on Zoom. And it's helpful. Sometimes it's even more helpful than being in the same room, actually, just to kind of focus in a different way, especially early on in the piece. Then when you get to more nuanced lessons, it's much nicer to have the in-person much more.
Oh, for sure. Effective. For sure. Well, I know we're running short on time here, so I would love to hear what advice you can offer to young musicians who are thinking about a career in music, because you've had such a fascinating career. So it'd be great to get your feedback on that.
Oh, advice. You know, everybody's very different. And so I would probably give very different advice depending on what course and path you want to take. But essentially, what I have learned is that the more open you are to the world around you and to just try not to have too many preconceptions, it's good to have goals and it's good to set those goals and, you know, have a sense of architecture to your life and what you hope to achieve and accomplish. But be open, because you just never know what life will throw in your way and circumstances out of your control. And I tend to be an optimistic person in general. And so I see the positive side of things, even when they're horrific and horrible. I try to learn and I try to grow. And that would be my advice, is just be open to growth, be open. Keep your ears open, keep your eyes open, and truly just keep dreaming. And the bigger the dream, the better. You know, just keep on seeking that unattainable something. And I never, you know, you started this conversation with, did you think that you would end up where you are now when you first started? And the answer is absolutely not. I had no idea where I would end up. And I still don't know where I'm going to end up in 20 years.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm open to it. And I'm very grateful for what I've had up to now and all the opportunities and all the figures in our music world that I've had contact with that have inspired me, that have shown me the way. And I would just say, seek those individuals out, you know, and follow your dreams.
Yeah.
And don't give up. Don't give up no matter what. Even when it looks like the whole world is coming to a standstill and, you know, there's no room for live music, just keep going, keep figuring it out. And there's got to be a way, and just do what you're passionate about and it will work out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much to Matt Heimovitz for sharing his story with us today. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Matt, make sure you check out the show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Hans Jensen, cello professor at Northwestern University's Beenan School of Music. We talk about his teaching philosophy, his two most recent books, Practice Mind and Cello Mind, and we get into the weeds on how to achieve superior intonation on the cello, one of my favorite topics. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.